Here we go. Andrew WK is here. It's the Urban Turban Show. Thanks for joining us. Every week we have a show about the mind, body, spirit. As you know, my journey is about spirituality. It's about love. It's about light. A few years ago, I hit rock bottom, lost everything in my life. I lost my job, my car, my home. My uncle passed away. My grandma passed away. My best friend passed away. I found myself smoking 30 cigarettes a day, having about 17 cups of coffee a day, down and out. But then I had a reality. I realized that there's too much love in this world, there's too much life in this world, there's too much light in this world, and what we must do is spread it. And this is my journey I've been on the last 4 years, and this show, my intention of this show, is to bring leaders and just bring minds that really want to spread love, spread light. My guest today is Andrew WK. He's a musician, he's an author, and he's a fellow radio DJ. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
I love your story. First, let me start off because I want to start off with the Paris events. You write for the Village Voice, and you wrote a great article about the Paris events. As a musician, and you know everyone talks about Paris, how horrible it was. As a musician, you've been on stage, you've been in Paris before performing. What was your first reaction when that happened?
Well, I was concerned about the band first and foremost, since I had met some of those gentlemen before in Eagles of Death Metal, and that was the first I heard about that specific part of the attack. So I quickly did whatever research I could and was very happy to find out that they were okay. I had just landed on a flight from New York, and as the events were unfolding. So I spent the next hour or so at the airport just doing research and experiencing the event from a distance there. But I was very glad that all the performers were okay, and obviously very devastated at the fact that the audience was not. But considering how many people were in there, it sounds like in the end the responders who reclaimed the venue did an excellent job of sparing many more lives. And whoever was there inside the building helping one another, they did a great job. Could have been much worse. Not that that makes it any easier to deal with, but it's always somewhat helpful to know that efforts were made and they were successful to diminish the fatalities.
Absolutely, and it's such a horrific incident. You wrote a great article. You write for the Village Voice, and you said, let me quote, they want war, but they will only get annihilation. And you say, this isn't us versus them. This is us versus it. What do you mean by it? Do you mean violence? Do you mean anger, fear?
Yeah. Yes, to a large degree. Whatever it would mean to you, meaning it, I don't feel like it's humans versus humans, because these sorts of events are not really human events. They are alien to us. They don't fit into the world as we understand it for very good reason. This is not the world that we have been striving to build and maintain over these many thousands of years. And so when an event occurs in the midst of that creation that is completely foreign to all our shared sensibilities, it doesn't give us any opportunity to really reckon with it. And I don't, as much as I despise these people, they still are people who have perpetrated this act. They still are human. They're just humans who have almost done everything they possibly can to remove the humanity from themselves. And that's the only way you could carry out one of these acts. I really don't see how a full person could engage in that type of violence without almost turning off every part of them that makes them human. They're not literally monsters. They're just people behaving in a monstrous way. They're more like a human who is almost entirely an animal, whereas most humans have the capacity for animalistic behavior and divine behavior. They have given themselves over to those lowest impulses. And that's it's very upsetting to see that. Whether you see a person in that state engaged in violence or even just engage in day-to-day life, it's hard to reckon with because, one, we know that we have those capacities somewhere inside of us, and we just never give in to them. We never even investigate them for very good reason. But when you see someone who's made their entire life goal to not only investigate those feelings, but to become that animal inside of them, that animal human, it is foreign and alien and monstrous.
Do you think, and so would you say that all humans are born with love, and do you think just that hate is something that's taught, or do you think that's almost some humans are almost born hateful?
I don't know. I don't know about that. I think that there's physical defects, if you want to call them that, that can make it easier for some people to think different ways. It's hard to know where these thoughts or these sensibilities emerge from, if they're even part of the mind in general. Can someone's wiring be in such a way that they are more inclined to that? It seems that's highly likely. Some people could be born not bad, but born with the capacity to be bad more easily than someone else. But I think that probably these people are much more similar to you and I than we would like to think, and they've just made extraordinary efforts to reach these places of hate and anger and violence. They have put all their energy into going there instead of running away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us try to overcome those feelings, but I think in these situations they are feeding those feelings to each other, to themselves. Almost, the word brainwashing is thrown around a lot, and I don't know if it's exactly the right word here. You can brainwash yourself. I mean, many of us are engaged in some sort of self-deception. So imagine if your entire life was devoted to deceiving yourself and distracting yourself of every part of yourself that is open-minded, that is loving, that is caring, that tries to rise above your weaknesses. What if you just made your life goal feeding into those weaknesses, amplifying those weaknesses, and defining your entire existence based on your lowest, worst, basest impulses and capacities?
I agree with you. I believe in addiction in a sense that I believe that we get used to what we're used to. So if your mentality state is you're used to partying, being positive, and really being caring and peaceful to others, you will continuously do that. And I believe if you are used to being negative and being very hard and being very hurtful, you also get used to that, and it just gets bigger and bigger.
I agree as well, and I think the troubling part is that many of these people think they are being positive. They think that what they're doing is good, maybe even for the greater good. And it's very hard to argue with someone in that state, because in order to maintain that point of view, they have to close out any other thought process.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the one way that I would try to get through to someone, is to show that they're not listening or open-minded to anything. We don't want to let ourselves fall into that same trap. It doesn't need to impact our behavior or our actions necessarily, but we owe it to ourselves to try to see things from as many sides as possible, even the sides that seem impossible to relate to. It's worth the effort just to try to gain understanding, because if we understand the enemy, we actually have a lot better of a chance to defeat it.
Absolutely. I hear you on that. I love what you say about that. Let's take a little sidestep, talk about your childhood. I actually grew up when I was a kid in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan.
And, oh, wow.
And you grew up in Michigan. And tell me about Michigan. Tell me what it was like at 4 years old learning piano lessons.
Well, that's, I thought I detected, when I heard your introduction to the show today, I thought I heard a bit of a Michigan or Midwest voice there. I was thinking about this a lot the last few days, because I lived in Michigan for those formative years between 4 and 18. As you said, I started taking piano lessons at age 4 and continued until about age 13. But all the things that I learned and was exposed to that have helped to reveal my life to me, they did happen for a large part in Michigan. although I haven't lived there as long as I lived other places, I ended up living in New York for even longer than Michigan. I don't feel like I'm from anywhere. And I was kind of distraught about that at first because I was born in California, and then I moved to Michigan at 4, and then moved to New York when I was 18. And now, for the most part, I've just traveled. I haven't really lived anywhere since around age, I don't know, I mean, 20, 21. More or less just have been on tour. I mean, there was times when I would return to New York for long stretches and times when I didn't have any particular home address, just put stuff in storage spaces and stayed in hotels, which I'm doing again now. But I definitely think that if I hadn't been had that Michigan experience, especially with those early musical encounters, I wouldn't be doing anything that I'm doing now.
And that piano teacher of yours really gave you light. That piano teacher really gave you a sense of, hope. Is that correct?
Well, it definitely showed me that this thing called music was really powerful. It wasn't a fluke. You could count on it. It was consistent. It was reliably powerful, unlike other parts of life that seemed very unreliable and frightening and confusing and frustrating. Here was something that I could always turn to called music that always worked, always made me feel good, and more than good. It made me feel like life had a purpose to it, had some key to it, that there were things that life was built on that were not just opinions or tastes or perspectives, but that there were actually core principles that you could live by, and that music could be one of them.
I believe that. I mean, I believe it to my soul. Steve Jobs says something that people with passion change the world in small ways and big ways, and I believe that word passion. When I got into radio, I was sort of a troubled kid, had a lot of issues internally, and didn't really have any direction, no confidence. And the minute I got into radio, I remember it was almost like an orgasmic feeling internally, just a sense of one with the universe. And it was amazing. I felt like the light was just turned on. All of a sudden, I was in darkness, and all of a sudden, I found a light bulb, and I turned a light switch on. Was that sort of the same thing with you, with music?
Yeah, definitely. I was so young at that time that it was difficult to put it into those kinds of words for myself or for someone else. All I knew is I just really liked the way it felt. But it was orgasmic, but it was orgasmic before I'd ever had an orgasm, you know, in the sexual sense, or even knew what that kind of idea was. All I knew was that it felt like this is what I was supposed to be doing with my time. Even if it wasn't always easy, even if there was parts about it that I didn't like practicing scales and trying to sight read and doing these recitals, it was one of the first times where I realized that there could be something that you were meant to do, even if you didn't want to do it. It went beyond that. It was what you should do. And that having that clarity really helped in a world, you know, growing up as a child that for me felt very frightening and very intense.
And I think the thing that's key to you, and it's key to a lot of people, and I say this on my show, it's when you try to force anything, you will falter in life. When you try to force, you know, a job or a relationship, when you freely try to, if you freely do something, you freely did the piano and you just kind of drifted towards it, there's a lot of freedom and you're flying throughout the world, are you not?
Yeah, I think that's a really hard lesson to learn because we're told oftentimes, especially as adults, to set goals and to plan out your life and to follow a very specific path that's not necessarily your own path or the path that is your destiny, but sort of a path of a reasonable adult existence, whether it's, you know, going to school and then college, and then you get married, and then you have a kid, or then you buy a house, then you have a kid, then you get a dog, then you have another kid, then you do this. So there seems like there's all this irresponsibility to this idea of floating through life or kind of going where life takes you. But it actually just takes a great deal of courage to cast oneself out into that flowing river and let it carry you along. It is frightening because there isn't security there, but you have security in a higher sense in that You are meant to do something. Everyone is meant to be a certain version of a human being, maybe even in ways that we would never think of, maybe even ways that we would think are bad. Mm-hmm. That's where it gets really tricky. But that your purpose, if you open yourself to it, like you're saying, will reveal itself to you. And the hardest part is believing that that's possible and then having the courage to follow through on it. I think a lot of the pressure to conform and to plan out one's life is simply out of fear, because it's so intense to not know. A lot easier to feel like you just go through these steps and then you're guaranteed to have a good life. But we know that doesn't always mean you're going to have a good life. You might have a very unfulfilling life. You might have a terrible life because you're fighting against this natural direction, like trying to swim upstream or something. But it's rewarded a lot of times. It's been romanticized. And unfortunately, there's a lot of pressure because all the people that have also chosen to do that want you to do it, but they feel like their choice was justified. You don't have to ever give in to it. And it doesn't matter how late in the game you decide to free yourself. It's it always will work out once you allow it to.
I love when you said that. Yeah, it is absolutely true. There's this pressure a lot of people feel like, and I know it so many times, oh, I'm too old to start something. I'm like, no, you're not. You're never too old to be free. Never.
Absolutely. And for all we know, that was all part of the plan anyway.
Right. And you grew up, you grew up in Michigan. Your dad's a professor. And what effect did your parents' marriage have on you when they were together? It must have been a positive effect for you to be so grounded.
Well, they went through their own challenging times, but they managed to come out the other side intact, which is quite miraculous. And I have a great deal of respect for them both, especially my mom, but my dad as well. I identify with both of them to a great extent, and I really feel like I'm a 50-50 combination of, well, the best and worst that they each have. So maybe it's like 25, 25, 25, 25. But there was never a doubt in my mind that they cared about me and they cared about my brother and they wanted us to do what we wanted to do or what we should do. They were the ones who made me believe that I could follow these impulses because they encouraged it. And they didn't encourage it in an overly present way either. They just gave me that space to do things that I was excited about. I mean, they could tell. But they also pushed me. You know, they pushed me, my mom especially pushed me into a lot of athletics that I was conflicted about, but ultimately learned to appreciate because I knew that being physically active made my brain feel better. I mean, it made me feel better about being alive, which was another very confusing thing, because how could this thing like swim practice at 5 a.m. for 2 hours before school started, how could that's something I really didn't want to do on so many levels and something that felt very painful, something I dreaded every morning. How come when I did it afterwards, I felt better? How come if someone had told me, well, you could just cancel swim practice and not go, I would say, no, that's not the answer either. It was when I realized that some kinds of discomfort, physical or even mental, emotional, spiritual discomfort was somehow enriching, you know, that it wasn't always about being comfortable or things being easy or things being pain-free. And I realized, you know, thanks to my mom and these kind of pushes into discomfort, that it actually made me have to grow as a person.
Absolutely. And let me tell you something, Andrew. You and I have something else in common. I was a swimmer, too. I played water polo in high school, and I do remember.
Oh, wow.
I do remember those 5 a.m. practices and getting in that chilling, freezing pool. And now I look back, I'm like, how in the world did that even happen?
I completely relate. I did water polo as well and really didn't like it.
Yeah. But it was it's a great experience, I think, you and I had, because it was about teamwork and working with each other.
Yeah, I did appreciate the team. I mean, swimming has slightly less of a team aspect because there's a lot of solo events, even though you're contributing points to the team, and there's relays, of course. But I did have fun with some of the other, you know, kids on the swim team that were my age. Some of them I had actually done swimming during the summer with. It was just a lot of swimming. My mom was obsessed with swimming. Being from California, she was always a lifeguard and always on swim teams, and she just wanted that for me. I guess I preferred it over any other sport. At least I was better at swimming than I was at basketball or baseball or soccer, although I did all of those as well. I did tennis, I did track and field. I mean, it was constant physical activity. The one thing I just realized is that if I don't have some kind of physical exertion, if I don't push myself into that place of physical discomfort, I'm not going to be living my best life. You know, I'm not going to be at my best level. And that's something I really hope that everyone gets to encounter. We're really, again, we're encouraged on many levels that a successful life is one where you don't have to push yourself, where you just sort of rest. I mean, we have these images of the ultimate achievement in life being kicked back on a lounge chair by the side of a pool, doing nothing. And of course, there's moments where that can be very appealing. It's not something that particularly I would ever, look forward to, but I understand that. But that's not the high point. That's not the result of all our efforts. And in fact, we know that if we did ultimately just lay around in the sun on a lounge chair, that we would probably die. Of course, we have to eat and drink water and use the restroom and do all that, but pushing ourselves out of, almost feeling like you're going to die through exercise. If you're really exercising hard, you kind of do feel like you're going to die. It feels like you should not be doing this. And yet somehow it actually makes you stronger, healthier, and better in spirit and mind. I mean, for me, that's the most important thing about exercise, whether I'm getting it by playing a show and running around and singing and headbanging and just completely covered in sweat, or whether it's lifting weights. What I know is that when I feel like that, I'm going to be a better person.
There's nothing like working. I mean, working out is so important, especially for the mind. It just cools the mind, and it just really works well with the mind. You're on tour, and you've been touring for a long time. What's your activity? Do you go on runs? Do you go on walks? Do you do yoga?
Well, the show is very physical. Mm-hmm. It's extremely challenging physically, and that was just a choice I made with this style of music. That just happens. I mean, I couldn't even hold back at this point and play the show without moving. So that is my heart rate's pretty much at the maximum level for the duration of the show. I'd say around 200 BPM for the whole show, and I'm covered in sweat, and that's just an intense cardio workout. So other than that, I don't really, I just do weights. There's times that I've done very hardcore air drumming sessions if I haven't had a gym to go to. But for most of my time on tour, that's just a high priority, finding a gym. And fortunately now, it's amazing. Since when I first started touring in 2001, 2002, you could never find gyms. You could never find fitness centers. I would have to take taxis 45 minutes away to find a gym. And even then, it was hard to find a gym that was open late. Now, the fitness revolution has exploded everywhere, and you can find 24-hour gyms relatively close to any major city, sometimes multiple locations in a city. It's been a tremendous blessing as, the rest of humanity, we've all found out that this is good. This is important. This is like having a grocery store. You'd have a gym. So that's, I don't care if I've only had 3 hours of sleep, I will go to the gym.
That's awesome. And have you ever meditated? Are you into meditation or no?
I've done that before. There was a stretch where I was doing it every day for about 45 minutes. And it was, talk about physically challenging, I was drenched in sweat by, even in the first 10 minutes. To sit still, and I really mean sit still, I didn't do it laying down because I found that to be too, it has to be that balance between rigidity and, sort of relaxation. And it was so physically demanding that, it was harder almost than any kind of exercise, the physical challenge. And I liked it. I found that I could, I sort of feel like I'm in a meditative state at all times. I haven't felt the need personally to formalize it as I did for that time. You can do walking meditation. You could basically live in a contemplative, detached, observational mindset, although I'm not that disciplined with it. I really admire people who do it in a very disciplined way every day.
Yeah, I mean, I do it every morning and every evening. It's just, for someone who is an addict and someone who used to drink a lot and party a lot, and we'll get into the definition of partying in a second with you, meditation has just, you know, it just made me so free. It's just, I tell my friends, it's almost like you just relax and you just, you know, observe and you just go.
Yeah, it's a tremendous gift to oneself. And it's hard to know what it's like until you really do it. And even from the brief month or two that I was doing it, it was a gift that kept on revealing itself on deeper and deeper levels. And I imagine it continues to unfold like that indefinitely.
Speaking of partying, let's talk about your definition of partying. Would it be accurate to say your definition of partying is living life to the fullest?
Yeah, if that's what one would want to define it as, it's not really definable in the best way. It really can be more or less whatever a person wants it to be for them. To me, it was just the most sort of exciting action word that I could think of. I mean, if being alive is sort of the ultimate state that we're aware of, then the second most awesome state where you're celebrating that state of life would be partying. I mean, it just seemed like a word that everyone could understand in an energetic way, and anyone could interpret in a way that was meaningful to them, but that no one could interpret it honestly as something other than joyous.
Mm-hmm. And joy is so very important. Tell me about the tours, and you've been traveling the world, and how much joy that brings you, and tell me about what you've learned just through the traveling around this great country and around the world.
Well, as is often the case with music, you see a common goodness. You see people at their best. That's, for me, the greatest privilege. What I get to do with this particular style of music or this particular discipline, this thing I'm focused on with partying, is it's all about the best feelings and the best parts of life, the best essences. So getting to be surrounded by people who are also interested in that, who want that, who are in that state of mind, I never really anticipated how great that would be, actually. I knew that's what the state of mind I wanted to be in. I wanted to make it my mission to live and promote that, just to be that, to manifest that, to conjure that joy up wherever we went. But when you realize that you're not alone in that effort, and that the other people who are going to be drawn to that are the people who are doing that too, then all of a sudden you get to be around people in that state of mind all the time. I mean, that's the best thing, whether we even speak the same language, whether it's a very different, you know, cultural, geographic atmosphere. There's a human phenomenon to that joy that is shared by every human I've ever encountered in these situations. It's always been very consistent. And you see people truly free. You can see it in their eyes and on their faces, and it's not just a kind of pandemonium. It's a type of true happiness. And that's, again, it's a genuine privilege to see people in that state, to be surrounded by people in that state.
And you've helped so many people out. I know people have helped you out. You're right for the Village Voice, and ask AWKK at villagevoice.com. You take questions, and let me ask you this question. There are so many people out there, Andrew, that go through depression. There are artists I know, musicians and actors and comedians, that go through a little drought, that they feel very lonely and they feel very insecure and they feel very lost. What do you do to get out of that drought? Do you still deal with that drought?
Everyone? Oh, yeah. That's continued to be a constant thing. I don't try to really get out of it anymore. I've been through it so many times now that it's almost kind of like that same feeling of exercise. It's a type of pain. It's a type of discomfort. It's physical. It's emotional. It's spiritual. It's mental. It's all-consuming, but I know that it will pass because I've been through it so many thousands of times now that I know it will pass. And it's still hard when you're in the midst of it. I often have thought, well, this time it's not going to pass. This one feels different. This is, you know, how could I ever have been so naive to think that this would ever be over? I don't try to get out of it. I just feel like it's like being sore after exercise. You know, if you lift a bunch of weights, your body's going to feel sore. You're going to feel like you injured it. And maybe you did injure it in a little way. And so that soreness is your body repairing itself, growing stronger, rebuilding itself to be bigger and better than it was before. And I feel like that's what sometimes these low moods are. They're your body recuperating from the intensity of life.
Mm-hmm.
And don't try to get out of it. If you try to avoid the soreness from exercise, then you're actually going to, you know, potentially truly injure yourself or never really grow. Let your body absorb what it's been going through. Let your spirit absorb what it's been going through and give it that space and that time. You know, don't try to force it. Don't feel bad about it. I've often felt bad about feeling bad. That doesn't help anything. I just know that it's like the up and downs of a roller coaster ride. And who wouldn't want a roller coaster ride without some ups and downs?
Mm-hmm. That's a great, I'm so glad you said that. That's such a great, brilliant way of saying it. It's almost like a soreness for the mind.
Yeah, soreness of the spirit. And if you can embrace it that way, it doesn't make it any less intense or any more fun. But if I look back over all the ups and downs, I know that there was something beautiful even in those low moments. The shadows and the light, the darkness and the brightness all mean something, you know, and we don't have to judge it. We don't have to figure it out. We don't have to understand it. We can just have faith that it is all part of our adventure here.
Absolutely. Do you have any books you could recommend? Are you a reader? Do you read any books that you could recommend for people? Maybe your one or two favorite books?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I like reading books. A really great book about these kinds of sadnesses is a book called The Conspiracy Against the Human Race by Thomas Ligotti, Ligotti. And I will give a bit of a warning that it is a very intense book. It's very challenging, not in its readability. It's beautifully written, very easy to read. I would recommend reading it very slowly because it's a kind of book that you could just savor each sentence, each page. But it will challenge you and throw you into the darkest of all darknesses. And I think that's it's been an incredible experience. One of my favorite writers, more than a favorite writer, is one of my favorite things I've ever encountered. I really recommend all his books. The Conspiracy Against the Human Race is a nonfiction book about the what he sees as the inherent negativity of existence. But he also is an incredible horror fiction, specifically short stories in the horror genre. And I don't mean horror in terms of maybe like what we think of as a haunted house or as a ghost jumping out from behind a corner, but rather the horror of fathoming the mystery and impenetrability of this world. So again, be warned, it's very heavy stuff, but it's very thrilling. And what's so encouraging about it is you'd think that reading this writing that is so dark would somehow make you more depressed. And in a way, it does. But there's something also extraordinarily comforting and exhilarating about it in a confounding way, in a way that I can't quite figure out. Why does it feel so good to read about something that in some ways feels so bad? But for someone who has, you know, wrestled with bad feelings, I found it to be ultimately an incredibly helpful and positive experience.
I'm here with Andrew W.K., The Conspiracy Against the Human Race, A Contrivance of Horror. He recommends that book. Now, Andrew, a couple more questions. Tell me about Glenn Beck. I know you have your own radio show. How's that experience been?
Oh, well, that's been a tremendous experience. I've never done a weekly radio show. It's, of course, available as a podcast as well. It's called America WK, and as you said, it was all because of Glenn Beck, the very popular radio show host himself, but also a TV host, an incredible performer on stage as well, a very successful writer, someone I never, ever thought would reach out to me for all kinds of reasons, not the least of which is how I look and my party mindset. I never thought Glenn Beck would want to have anything to do with me. But not only did he want to have something to do with me, he gave me my own show on his network. And I was so surprised by this and was so excited about the discordance in that opportunity that I really didn't even hesitate for a second. And the show itself, America WK, it's really about what we're talking about now. I'm just trying to go as deep in as I can into life, mm-hmm. into everything about life. And it's just me and you, listener, tearing away at what it means to be alive.
Well, Andrew WK, you've given us a lot of life and a lot of light and love. Thank you for joining us. I just want to tell everyone, by the way, you can follow him at Andrew WK on Twitter. He also is going to be touring, so we want to give you a shout out. You're going to be where, Boston for New Year's Eve? Is that correct?
Yes, my full band is playing a New Year's Eve show in Boston, which is very exciting. We've never played there on New Year's Eve. We played a couple New Year's Eve shows lately, so this one I have very high expectations for. It's a great venue. We played many times. We have a balloon drop. We're going to have a countdown to midnight, and I would love for people to be there.
Andrew WK, thanks for joining us. AndrewWK.com. Thanks for partying, and thanks for having us, inviting us to your party.
Thank you so much, Swami. Thank you for doing what you do and for making me a part of it.